Yahya Hegazi is a 30-year-old Egyptian-American who grew up in Falls Church and graduated from George Mason University. She returned to Egypt following the 2011 revolution. She got married to a man named Mohammed Hassanein. And with their wedding money, they founded something called the Beledi Foundation, where they worked to educate and rehabilitate street children in Cairo. In May of 2014, amidst a broader crackdown on civil society, police forces raided the group without a judicial warrant. They arrested Aya and her husband and several others and charged them with a raft of very serious charges, including human trafficking, sexual exploitation of children, inciting children to participate in street protests, charges that carry a maximum of a life sentence. They've been in prison ever since. Human Rights Watch has called the case a travesty of justice. They've been in prison almost 3 years now, and that violates Egypt's own penal code, where detainees are only allowed to be held for 2 years under pretrial and provisional detention rules. There's been very frequent prolonged postponements of the trial. They have not been allowed to meet with their lawyers privately. And I was at a session just a couple of weeks ago where the verdict was supposed to be heard. Aya was in the defendant's cage in the courtroom. Her husband came in. They embraced very tightly. They only see each other in the defendant's cage weeks or months apart. It was a very moving scene. And then the judge postponed the verdict inexplicably, as many postponements have occurred in this case, to April 16th. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. It's hard to know, but I very much doubt that Hegazi will be a topic of conversation today between Trump and Sisi, and she'll be forgotten by the leaders of both the countries she's a citizen of.
And finally, Sharif, before we go, the whole issue of not raising human rights, as the Trump administration has said they will not do in this meeting, and the significance of Sisi for Trump, that he was the first person to call and accept his call to congratulate Trump on his election.
Well, like I said, I think the main difference in the relationship will be one of tone and rhetoric. I mean, they see in each other kindred spirits, that they both have a populist slant that brought them to power. They use authoritarian language and authoritarian tactics to enforce their policies. They both have very dark views of the Muslim Brotherhood and look to annihilate any and all opposition. But I think it also begs the question of how much the actual U.S. relationship will change, because we have to realize that Obama before him echoed decades of U.S. policy towards Egypt, which prioritizes perceived national security interests over human rights and
rule
of law.
Sharif, we have to leave it there. I thank you so much. But we're going to do part two of our conversation and post it online. Sharif Qudus is Democracy Now!'s correspondent and Cairo Nation Institute fellow. Breaking news from Russia. At least 10 people have died in two bombings in the St. Petersburg this morning.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:02 p.m. Up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the All Ages fundraiser and crowdfunding launch for Room to Grow on Wednesday, April 5th at 7 p.m. at the Doug Fir in Portland. Room to Grow will be a film about the lives of middle and high school LGBTQ and allied kids. And the kickoff event will feature music from Matt Albert, John Garcia, and the Bridging Voices Youth Choir. Again, that's Room to Grow, Wednesday, April 5th at 7 p.m. at the Doug Fir, 830 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KBOO 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboo AIR 2017.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting the candidate forum for Portland Public School District Board candidates on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. This forum is in partnership with the Oregon Parent Teacher Association and Communities and Parents for Public Schools. More voter information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland's Socially Responsible Investment Committee manages a Do Not Buy list of corporations. To learn more about it, KBOO News Director Zelos Marchand interviews a member of the committee.
Senate Democrats now have enough support to hold up a confirmation vote on Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch.
And a Mexican newspaper is shutting down because of threats and violence aimed at reporters.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 3rd, 2017. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Mahdi. Last week, Governor Kate Brown replaced a majority of the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission members, the panel that determines the official policy for the Oregon DEQ. The Environmental Quality Commission is a five-member panel appointed by the governor. The commission serves as the rulemaking board and determines policy for the Oregon DEQ, with members typically serving a four-year term. Two of the three members that were replaced still had more than 2 years left on their appointments. The move is a continuation of a shakeup at DEQ that occurred after the publication of the Portland heavy metal air toxins problem and Oregon DEQ's lack of response. One of the commission members who is being replaced, Colleen Johnson, reportedly stated she felt the firings were due to the fact the panel did not choose the candidate for DEQ director that the governor wanted.
As of this morning, Senate Democrats now have enough support to hold up a confirmation vote on Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. While Democrats reached the 41-vote threshold required to block Gorsuch's nomination, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted 11-9 along straight party lines to send the nomination to the full Senate. This sets up a political showdown between Republicans and Democrats and could lead to a change in longstanding Senate rules. Under current rules, Democrats can support a procedural hurdle called a filibuster, requiring a supermajority of 60 votes to allow a confirmation vote. Senate Republicans, led by Mitch McConnell, have threatened to force a vote by changing Senate rules and allowing for a simple majority vote for Supreme Court justices. This move, considered extreme even by typical partisan party standards, is often called the nuclear option. Republicans hold a 52-48 majority in the Senate, and without the filibuster rule, would be able to confirm Gorsuch along party lines. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer suggested that, rather than resorting to the nuclear option, Republicans ask President Trump to replace Gorsuch with a more moderate nominee. Democrats are also still upset with the way Judge Merrick Garland, former President Obama's pick to fill the same Supreme Court vacancy, was treated by Republicans last year when they refused to even consider the nomination. As it now stands, only four Democrats oppose a filibuster, four short of the eight that Republicans need.
The U.S.-China summit meeting, scheduled at the Mar-a-Lago Resort later this week, will provide a forum for discussion of deep policy divergences between two very different personalities. One of the top issues will be how the U.S. president will use crucial U.S.-China trade ties to pressure Beijing to do more to rein in North Korea. A top priority for the protocol-conscious Chinese is the risk that the U.S. president could publicly embarrass the Chinese president after several foreign leaders experienced awkward moments with the new U.S. president. Both sides are keeping expectations low for tangible results from the summit, billed as an informal, quote, get to know you, unquote. Whatever else happens, there won't be any golf diplomacy. China has launched a renewed crackdown on golf, closing 111 courses in an effort to conserve water and land, and telling members of the Communist Party to stay off the links.
More than 500,000 college graduates who participated in the federal student loan forgiveness program may not receive the benefits they were promised. The federally approved Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, passed in 2007 with bipartisan support, allows graduates to work for a nonprofit or public service organization for up to 10 years and have a significant part of their student loans be forgiven. Last year, four student loan borrowers sued the U.S. Department of Education after the department retroactively rescinded loan forgiveness approval letters the borrower had received. In an official filing for the lawsuit, the Department of Education claimed the approval letters were in error, were non-binding, and had been retroactively rescinded, and the students now owe the entire amounts, even though they had worked at the nonprofits for years. Joining the borrowers in the lawsuit is the American Bar Association, claiming that the Department of Education had acted arbitrarily and capriciously.
In 2009, Portland became a city funded by investment securities as a way to support and maintain financial growth. Over a period of several years, a citizen advisory committee was formed. With the support of climate justice and human rights organizations, citizens are appointed by city council members to manage a "do not buy" list of corporations that the city of Portland finds unethical. Hyung Nam, a citizen on the Socially Responsible Investment Committee, spoke with KBOO's Zelos Elos Marchant to find out more.
I have with me Hyung Nam, part of a citizen advisory for the city that's been appointed by the city council, based on previous climate justice and human rights groups. Hyung Nam, thank you so much for joining us here on KBOO. Can you tell me about the forthcoming April 5th meeting?
Yes. So this meeting has been dragged out for months. And basically, the Socially Responsible Investment Committee, which I'm on, spent over a year researching the corporations that our city invests our public dollars in. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of our money that the city invests in everything from Chevron to Wells Fargo to Caterpillar. And we picked out the worst of the worst companies that are the most controversial to examine and do our own research and also take public testimony about these companies on their human rights record, their climate environmental record, but also their labor practices, their ethics and fraud, a whole range of issues. There are basically seven criteria that we look at on environment, social issues, and corporate governance. And from that, we created a list of nine companies that to put on the do not buy list, which is the charge of the committee. And we presented that report at the we submitted that report at the end of September 2016, and we presented that report, I believe, in October or November to City Council. And we had packed hearings. We had hundreds of people show up to these hearings to testify about why it was so important, especially to put companies like Wells Fargo and Caterpillar, Nestle, on the do not buy list. However, City Council has been really reluctant to name some of these companies on the do not buy list. They had no issue with Walmart or Chevron or things like that, or even Nestle. But they've been very resistant to the two companies that for many in the community have been the most important that we've prioritized, and that is Wells Fargo and Caterpillar.
Do you think that's because of the intersections of how our universities are funded? I understand the divestment movement was really strong in universities, and that is still creating a cause and effect situation there. Has that come up as part of why they might be resisting?
Absolutely, yeah. And so it's interesting that, you know, for divestment from, even though technically what we're talking about is not divestment, it's a similar idea, right? Because in divestment, you immediately share, you immediately sell the investments, which means that there could be a loss and then not buy any more from those companies. Whereas ours just puts them on a do not buy list, meaning that we hold on to those securities until they mature, and they might mature in a few months or in a year. But once they mature, we never buy those companies' securities again, never invest in that company again until they change their behavior. So in the long term, it has the same effect as divestment. But really, I think the point of our whole do not buy list and this kind of campaign is not that, you know, the amount of money Portland puts into any of these companies is that significant, but it's publicly naming them and shaming them, because these are companies that, you know, their business model depends on having a good public image. They spend millions of dollars on their corporate PR, right, public relations, and they know that their bad image leads to loss of profits. So by naming them more than just not investing in them, we put pressure on these companies, and it's a part of doing public education. You know, whether you're a customer in Wells Fargo, if Wells Fargo gets named, you're going to think, oh, if the city thinks it's bad enough to name Wells Fargo to not invest in them, I probably should not bank with them as well.
That is a really great case. Can you tell our audience members what some of these companies' policies are that have earned them the special place of the do not buy list? I think a lot of people are familiar with the Wells Fargo investing in things like Apple. And can you take a step further? I don't know if our audience really understands like what Caterpillar has to do with our city apart from inconveniencing our travel plans during summertime.
Well, you know, with every company that we put on the do not buy list, it wasn't because of one criteria alone or one issue. It was because they had a whole slew of issues. So to begin with Caterpillar, I think one issue that has been internationally known that people have struggled for many years, and we had a lot of public testimony on, is their human rights record. So Caterpillar manufactures these bulldozers. And they, in fact, I wrote an op-ed in the Portland Business Journal about this as well, and it's also in our Socially Responsible Investment Committee report, that these bulldozers are not just regular bulldozers. They are co-designed by the Israeli Defense Forces. They are armored, they have optional machine gun mounts, and they're used as a weapon. And we also had Rachel Corrie's parents come testify to us, because Rachel Corrie was murdered by Israelis using this armored weapon, that as she was standing in front of, I believe it was a Palestinian doctor's home that was being bulldozed and destroyed. And so she stood in front of it with a bright, you know, orange vest, and they ran her over and killed her.
So Rachel Corrie, was she a native Palestinian or somebody
from
the U.S.?
She's a student. She was a college student at Evergreen University in Washington, who went to the occupied territories to learn more about this issue and to stand up for human rights. And she was killed using this equipment. And that was not the only case. People have been putting pressure on Caterpillar for over 10 years for destroying the homes of Palestinian people like that. And that company has refused to respond to any of these concerns. And by the way, in 2012, many different investment companies or investments like TIAA CREF divested from Caterpillar. And but anyway, that's just one issue that I brought up. It's not the only issue. Caterpillar, their headquarters was just recently raided by federal agencies from the IRS, the SEC, and one other agency over $2.4 billion in tax evasion that they've been doing for over 10 years. We've known about this for years, and that's just one other example of what a horrible company they are. Some others include some other horrible companies, they get tax subsidies from states, right, saying that we will have an operation in your state if you give us, you know, I think they got something like $199 million in tax subsidies from several different states, and then they play states off of each other. In some cases, I forget if it was North Carolina or another state, they, after receiving the tax subsidy, they cut and run to another state. And in some cases, like I think their operation in Texas, they also cut jobs to move their operations to Mexico. And so we knew all these horrible things about that company, labor practices as well. And for those reasons, we put them on the do not buy list in September of 2016. Since the election happened, companies like Caterpillar and Wells Fargo have shown that they are indeed the worst of the worst, given a new opportunity to be bad. Under the Trump administration, Donald Trump has said he will build his walls only using Caterpillar equipment. And also, when Doppel happened, when sacred Native American sacred sites and ancestral burial grounds were destroyed, as a precursor to building the pipeline, that was done using Caterpillar equipment. I mean, that equipment is used for mining operations all over the world.
So how does your committee make sure that the city honors this do not buy list? You've made it clear that there's a couple businesses, Caterpillar is one of them, that the city's a little reluctant to let anybody know that it's on the do not buy list. What does your committee do about that, and how can Portlanders make sure that information's out there and that it's supported?
Well, you know, our committee also heard testimony from a coalition of many human rights groups and climate justice groups, basically representing about 10,000 Portlanders. Every group from Enlace to 350 to groups, Jobs with Justice, and so on. And so what city council needs to do is just read our report and listen to public testimony. There's been overwhelming public testimony in support of our report to not invest in these companies. And they need to listen to us rather than listening to Wells Fargo vice presidents or listening to a few people from the Jewish community that will equate putting Caterpillar on the do not buy list with delegitimizing Israel. We should remember that we had many progressive Jewish organizations, including Jewish Voices for Peace, testify in favor of putting Caterpillar on the do not buy list as a way of helping peacefully put pressure to work out a negotiation in the occupied territories for a solution there, rather than continuing the problems that have continued for way too long, including having people so desperate that they turn to other means besides peaceful solutions. And also, that's another issue that's become much worse. After the Trump election, there's been a major increase in destruction of Palestinian homes and expanding settlements in the occupied territories by Israel.
That's incredible. Do we have a number on that?
I can't pull it up offhand, but there's been a really good article in Haaretz recently about.
Goodness, I almost don't even know where to go from there. That's a lot of really deep information. How can people prepare for this meeting, and what can they expect, and how can they stay involved after it?
Yeah, so what I recommend, two of the major organizations that have been really educating the public and also testifying to not only city council, but also earlier to our Socially Responsible Investment Committee, is Enlace and also Occupation Free Portland. And you could easily just Google those groups and find it, and you will find information, details about the city council hearing and detailed information about these companies and what we want the city to do. There are basically two options. One is go with the committee's recommendations to put all these nine companies on the do not buy list. And the other, it would be a prioritized option of slightly less than those nine companies, but really focusing on the most urgent companies. And the other thing I forgot to talk about is opposing the resolution that is being proposed by our treasurer, Jennifer Cooperman, who, by the way, in the 1990s was a Goldman Sachs vice president selling mortgage securities. But their proposal, this is really important to talk about. Their proposal, a lot of people may not know why it's problematic, but their proposal is to use Morgan Stanley Capital International information. It's MSCI is a service that Portland pays for. It's $35,000, more than $35,000 a year to rate companies on environment, social, and governance performance. And it's very misleading because it is not the same thing as when the Socially Responsible Investment Committee does research about these companies. There is a lot of important information that is lacking. And also the methodology of the way that they evaluate these companies. For example, Wells Fargo is evaluated. They get an overall score, right? But that score comes from rating them on things like business ethics and fraud. Mm. Well, according to their methodology, you could imagine Wells Fargo gets one of the lowest scores for business ethics and fraud, but that has a zero weight. So it has no effect on the way that that company is rated overall. And so the problem is that this is proprietary information. They won't let me share any of these documents. They won't let anyone look at these documents. So nobody will know how these companies are rated. And nobody will know whether Portland is nobody will know why Portland is buying or not buying any securities in any of these companies, because it'd be proprietary information. So it's not transparent. Mm-hmm. It is undemocratic, as opposed to our committee. Every meeting had to be public. We could not even write emails to each other because our communications had to be public. It's a totally democratic process that was open to the public, for the public to come witness, to testify to, and so on. It is completely different. And also with us, we did so much research. I mean, we were all volunteers on this committee. We did so much research. And without doing that research, if we only relied on their reports, we would not have really understood these companies, because there's so much that these reports excluded. But the most important thing to remember is that we can't trust this company to rate these companies properly. It is undemocratic and not transparent. And it's based on a flawed methodology that gives high ratings to companies because they do not count how horrible these companies are, even when they score so badly.
The atrocities that they do.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. I think a lot of people don't, you know, we hear proprietary information, but don't really understand what it is, but you just broke it down beautifully. Well, you heard it first here from Hyung Nam. You too can be a part of the divestment movement and hurting companies where it counts and making them accountable at the ground level in your own city for that. So the next meeting coming up for the citizen advisory to the city on being socially responsible for our investments is April 5th, 2 p.m. at the Portland building. Thank you, Hyung Nam. Thank you very
much.
Hey, come again now.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, mostly cloudy with a low around 42, light and variable wind. Tomorrow, 20% chance of rain after 11 a.m., mostly cloudy, with a high near 63. Today in history, in 1930, Raf Dafari Makinen was crowned Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, and in 1968, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his mountaintop speech to a rally of striking sanitation workers at the Mason Temple Church of God in Christ headquarters in Memphis, Tennessee, less than 24 hours before he was assassinated. Our quote of the day comes from Dr. King, who said, "All we say to America is, be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they hadn't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere, I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere, I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere, I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere, I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right. And so, just as I say, we aren't going to let dogs or water hoses turn us around. We aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. We're going on."
There's a new class of anti-cancer drugs called checkpoint inhibitors that work by releasing what researchers call a molecular brake. These drugs allow the immune system to recognize and attack cancer cells the same way it fights infections from bacteria or viruses. Some currently available checkpoint inhibitors have a list price close to $150,000 a year. The FDA recently approved a new drug for advanced melanoma that has a cost of $256,000 a year. The treatment can mean long-term survival for around 20% of patients. Health insurers have had success in demanding price concessions in some drug categories, like diabetes, though discounting is much less common for innovative cancer drugs. Net price growth for branded oncology drugs averaged 4.8% in 2015. The global market for cancer immunotherapies alone is expected to grow more than fourfold, from $17 billion in 2015 to $76 billion by 2022.
Imprisoned journalist and FSRN commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal has scored a decisive and possibly life-saving legal victory in his two-year fight to receive effective treatment for hepatitis C. The case, Abu-Jamal versus Wetzel, has broader implications for prisoners in need of life-saving medical treatment. In this commentary, Mumia Abu-Jamal describes the state of healthcare behind bars and the hospital and courtroom odyssey that resulted in the order that he receive Hep C treatment beginning this week.
The illusion of correctional medicine. In the netherworld of American prisons, one must jettison any medical assumptions one brings in from the so-called free world. We've been conditioned to see nurses as sweet sources of solace, and doctors as people dedicated to healing the sick and easing our pain. In prison, new roles govern medicine and care. Here, money is master. The ill are all but ignored. This may seem harsh, but I must assure you, reality is even harsher. Recently, I wrote of jailhouse lawyer Dennis Solo McKeithen and his battle to get examined and treated for the painful nerve disorder known as shingles. As I read this trial transcript, I found the remarkable comments and questions by the judge instructive. He asked essentially if the company hired by the DOC to provide health care had a conflict because, as a private company, its interests were to make money by refusing to provide medications needed by prisoners. The witness denied his suggestion, but the judge had hit a nerve. From 2015 to today, my lawyers and I have been demanding real treatment for my hepatitis C infection. The DOC initially filed a false affidavit which justified a U.S. magistrate's dismissal of my own suit. The DOC argued that my hepatitis was fine, that it could go years without treatment. A federal judge disagreed and held a hearing which showed the affidavit was false, and months later declared the DOC its so-called protocol was unconstitutional. The DOC fought back, arguing that my Hep C was at a low level. The judge again disagreed, declared the protocol unconstitutional a second time, and ordered me treated. the DOC essentially ignored the court order for close to 2 months, and earlier this week subjected me to more testing. Well, the results just came back. Not only do I have advanced hepatitis C, I have cirrhosis of the liver called F4, because the DOC didn't want to spend the money to treat my infection. The DOC said it would cost them $600 million. It may only cost me my life. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Violence against journalists is on the rise around the world. El Norte, a newspaper in Ciudad Juarez, announced this weekend they're closing down all operations because of the increasing threats and violence against reporters in Mexico. The move was prompted by the assassination last month of one of the paper's Chihuahua City reporters, Miroslava Breach Valducea, who was murdered by unknown gunmen outside her home on March 23rd. The newspaper's owner, Oscar Cantu Murguia, denied that he had been personally threatened and said that financial concerns had also been part of the decision. Employees learned of the closure when they read it in their paper on Sunday. The last print edition of El Norte was published on Sunday, April 2nd. The newspaper's website is also due to close. However, no date for that has been yet announced. And as of this afternoon, the website was still up and running current news items.
Drugs like spice, K2, fentanyl, kratom, and others have made headlines in recent years as the number of so-called legal highs or novel psychoactive substances has grown dramatically around the world. A few years ago, the nation of New Zealand adopted a new, innovative approach to controlling drugs. The idea was that substances should be regulated and controlled according to the harms they cause. To learn more, KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke recently with Stephen Blythe, communications manager for the New Zealand Drug Foundation.
Yeah, hi, I'm Stephen Blythe. I'm the communications manager at the New Zealand Drug Foundation.
Tell me about the New Zealand Drug Foundation. What kind of work do you guys do?
Yeah, we're a charity. We were formed in 1989 to bring about a New Zealand free from drug harm. So we were founded by doctors who were concerned about some of the ways that drug issues were being handled at the time, and they wanted to come up with evidence-based approaches that actually help people make good decisions about whether they're going to, when they choose to use, help make sure that people can get treatment if they need it. And over the years, because obviously we've been going for more than 25, we've worked on alcohol, we've worked on tobacco policy, and we're currently working, a lot of our focus is around illegal drugs.
What is New Zealand drug policy like?
It's a bit of a mixed bag, to be fair. Our main law was passed in 1975, right after Nixon was talking about basically the war on drugs. So our main legislation we consider it to be out of date, and we want to see it change. The actual drug policy, which has been written in the last couple of years, is on much sounder footing. It's not about criminalizing people, it's about making sure they get help if they need it. And the three guiding principles to that are innovation, proportion, and compassion. And they are very sound things to base policy on, rather than throwing the book at people, which has long-term consequences. The third part of our law or policy setting is something called the Psychoactive Substances Act, and that came around following quite a spiral in use in what at the time were called legal highs. But this, it's the over-the-counter available drugs, the new types of drugs in the packets you could buy at a corner store. So the legislation came in as an effort to get control of the availability of those drugs and make sure that people weren't coming to harm from them.
Right, these are called novel psychoactive substances. New psychoactive substances, but when you're talking about something like kratom or salvia or plants that have been around for thousands of years, calling them new is just a little weird. I've heard of this law. A couple of years ago, you passed a brilliant law. You had to prove harm. There are all kinds of... I mean, it was really brilliant. But what happened?
Yeah, so the law was passed by all but, in our parliament, by all but eight of the politicians. They were very strongly behind it. And then there was an interim period before the full effect of the law could come into force. And in that year, there was a lot of media coverage, a lot of public concern about how visible the use of these novel drugs were. It was... there were the people queuing, and there's a halt on the streets, and there's all sorts of probably public, which probably should be rightly considered public nuisance, and people didn't want them being sold in their neighbourhoods. And the politicians essentially reversed their view, and they voted for some changes to the law, which have essentially made it it's not working. it's not working in that the goal of the law was to allow substances that were considered low risk to be legally sold, and that required a producer, a manufacturer, to have done the testing and then bring that evidence to the people regulating the law, and they're about to show it. Because of some changes in 2014, nobody's brought any substances that they consider low risk, and while we do have far fewer of them, none are illegally available. Their availability is much less than in the heyday. The law really hasn't achieved its purpose in that it would allow low-risk products to come into the market. Mm.
Now, you have a kind of medical cannabis law. I know that your Peter Dunn, your health minister, associate health minister, was talking about that at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs hearing. We're taping this in Portland, Oregon, where we have legal adult use marijuana, legal medical marijuana. People can grow a few plants, have the plant product. Your medical cannabis law isn't quite like that, though.
No, there's no specific medical cannabis law. Any drugs that are not considered through our Medicines Act and have been established and approved for use have to come through a different route. a different route. For someone who wants to use medical cannabis for a particular condition, they have to have their general practitioner or doctor fill in some paperwork, which gets submitted to our Ministry of Health, who then determines whether that's a legitimate use. That therefore is putting a very high bar. The only medicines that are currently being authorised are the pharmaceutical medicines, are Tilray's and...
But Tilray, the Canadian producer.
Oh, Tilray, yeah. and Sativex. There we go. And obviously they're not terribly affordable by everyone, and there's no public funding for or insurance funding for those medications. So the law itself is allowing for some cannabis medicines, but it's highly restrictive. What we're waiting really to see is a wider availability of different product types that have good dosage information, and then the strains and stuff within them have become available. Because we do not have any growing within New Zealand, they have to be imported. There's big queues basically to get imported medicines. We can't import from the United States because of the legislation. So while many people want to see change, we're in a bit of a conundrum. Last year, the Drug Foundation did some polling, and we wanted to find out where the New Zealand public stood on this. And over 80% of those polled do support a change to medical cannabis. So we believe that it's just a matter of time as more evidence becomes available about the efficacy of the medicines and for different conditions. And also the medical community see the benefits. So it's slow, but we're positive that change will come. Hmm.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
The organization BARC's mission is to transform Mount Hood National Forest into a place where natural processes prevail, where wildlife thrives, and where local communities have a social, cultural, and economic investment in its restoration and preservation. We're fortunate now to have live in the KBOO studios Courtney Ray, she's the community organizer at BARC, and calling in, not live in the studio, but live somewhere, is Mason Miller, a volunteer hike leader, to discuss BARC's upcoming events, the April Lichen Hike and the People's Forest Forum on April 15th. Welcome, Courtney, and welcome, Mesa.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Oh, thanks for coming in. First, I thought BARC was an acronym, so could you tell our listeners what it actually stands for? It's not an acronym.
It's not, but it's a really great question and a great way to introduce BARC. The name comes from the Barker, which is kind of a historical personality, that person who would stand out on the street and call attention to something that the public should be made aware of, especially in terms of threats to public interest. And that has also developed to include more things, like bark is the protective layer of the tree, for example, right. And we are a forest defense group, so that's appropriate. Or a dog will bark when there is some danger. And we are also watchdogging the activities of Mount Hood National Forest.
What a great name. There's at least three layers of meaning there.
It works. It's very multifaceted. Yeah.
And what does BARC do as an organization? I mentioned kind of their mission statement in the introduction.
Right. So we're a place-based organization, which means we are focused on Mount Hood National Forest and some of the surrounding public lands, Bureau of Land Management lands and places like that. What we want to see is that the Forest Service is held accountable to managing that public land in the benefit for the most people, and moving away in particular from the commercial extraction that has been really the main focus of national forest management over the last 100 years. So the commercial timber program or any kind of fossil fuel infrastructure across those public lands would be things that we are opposing.
And this is, we should clarify, it is definitely federal government public lands. I know we've done many stories recently on the Elliott State Forest,
right.
And that is state, and the state controls that. So you're working directly with the federal government organizations on this, the Forest Service?
Yeah, the Mount Hood Forest Service is a federal agency, and they are tasked with managing the lands of Mount Hood. So it's about 1 million acres there. That's our local Forest Service that we engage with. Those are the folks that you'll see driving around while you're out in the forest. So they manage things like recreation and wildlife, as well as the commercial timber program. And so we have